previously.
Leah, are you with us?
I am. Hi.
Can you kind of start from the beginning of your fertility journey? And
my husband and I started a few months after we got married to try to have a baby, and actually got pregnant and had a late first trimester miscarriage. And we thought, oh, it's just a fluke. We'll try again. And we tried and tried and tried, and nothing ever happened. So then we finally decided it was time to see a specialist. So that's when we went to Texas Fertility Center and started our journey.
This is Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
Good afternoon. I'm Dr. Thomas Vaughn with the Texas Fertility Center, and this is our weekly hour of talking about fertility and associated gynecological diseases. Remember, we can be found at www.txfertility.com. There's a wealth of information on our website. Please don't hesitate to check it out. I think you'll find answers to a lot of your questions. Also, don't hesitate to call us here. We're at 390-1370, Talk Radio 1370 AM. Today, I have a guest with me, Dr. Devin Garza, who's a gynecologist with the Renaissance. Good afternoon.
Good morning. How's it going?
Right, we're doing great. Dr. Garza is a member of an OB-GYN group, the Renaissance, which is in North Austin, next to the new Women's Hospital at North Austin Medical Center. This hospital is near North Mopac and Palmer. We're so glad you're here.
And
what we thought we might talk about today are disease processes that sort of overlap fertility, that are gynecological problems, but overlap fertility, and also are just regular disease processes. And one of them is endometriosis. So we thought we might kind of delve into this a little bit. Have you ever seen anybody with endometriosis? Never, huh?
No.
So you just started practicing yesterday, right?
Yeah.
Because it is so common. Oh, my gosh, how common is it? It's estimated that 5% of women will suffer from this disease. Now, that's all women. That's kind of like postmenopausal and everything. So if you really take it into the reproductive age group, it's even higher, and maybe as many as 10 million women. So, Devin, tell our audience, what is endometriosis?
Endometriosis, the simplest way to put it, is it's a condition. Disease, I think, is a little stiff, but I think if you just call it a condition whereby the lining of the uterus, the term for that is just endometrium, that's the name of it, is found outside of the uterus. Histologically, or looking at that tissue scientifically, it is identical to the tissue found within the uterus that's called the endometrium. And when it's in a place that's it doesn't belong, so to speak, it can literally obtain a blood supply inside the abdominal cavity, usually in the pelvic region. Of course, that's where the female reproductive organs reside, the uterus, the tubes, and the ovaries. And it essentially lives there in a position that it's not regularly supposed to be, so to speak.
You know, in the old days, they used to have these funny names of endometriosis interna and endometriosis externa. If anyone is kind of searching the internet, and the interna was where endometriosis grows in the wall of the uterus among the muscle fibers, which can really cause some bad menstrual cramps. And we now call that adenomyosis. So the endometriosis externa, the thought was it was external to the uterus completely. And as you said, Devin, it's most likely on the pelvic organs. The second most common place is the gastrointestinal system. It can be on the bowel. It can even get into the appendix. So by definition, just what you said is endometrium, the inside line of the uterus, is supposed to come out with a menstrual period, somehow starts growing on the inside of the abdomen. One of the popular theories is that during a menstrual period, some of the cells go backwards, back through the fallopian tubes and spill in the pelvis and grow. So I think it's fair to say then the majority of time we see this after a woman begins her period and is not seen in women that are prepubertal.
Yes.
And so in reproductive age is the most common time in a woman's life. And in menopause, actually, it is curable if it hasn't caused a problem at that time and women have lost ovarian function. It will tend to go away because the ovary actually feeds it.
that tissue, exactly like you said, is completely dependent on the hormones that come from the ovary. So frequently when we're managing endometriosis, and I know we'll talk about that a little bit more in the program, we tend to use therapies or even await oncoming menopause to kind of point our treatment towards decreasing what the ovary does in its stimulatory process.
It makes sense. If the ovary is responsible for nourishing the disease, then to interfere with ovarian function may help treat the disease. Right. You know, it's kind of interesting also because it can be present itself in so many ways. It can present itself as just spots on support ligaments or the peritoneal lining. That's the inside lining of the pelvis. And even sometimes can be a collection in an ovary. And of all things, it's called a...
endometrium.
An endometrium, of which commonly some people have referred to as a chocolate cyst. Yeah. And interestingly, even though laparoscopy is the definitive way or the gold standard of diagnosing endometriosis, usually you can't see it. Sometimes you can see it with ultrasound if you have this chocolate cyst.
Why? You know, that's just a terrible thing to say, chocolate cyst. People out there are probably going, what in the world?
Yeah, so why did they call it a chocolate cyst?
During a laparoscopic procedure or an open procedure, laparoscopic, of course, is the preferred ability surgically to go through with minimally invasive process, tiny incisions, high-tech instruments, to be able to actually visualize what you're talking about, these smaller areas of coalescence of this endometrial tissue, or when it's found in the ovary, the process being contained in this little space for so long, essentially is old blood. And so old blood, when you tap into that little area, comes out and it drains, and, you know, for lack of a better word, it just kind of looks like
chocolate syrup. It sure does.
It sounds terrible, but it does.
But that's where the information has come from, or the description is just from what it looks like whenever you get into the cyst. Now, when a patient is undergoing an ultrasound and an ovarian cyst is seen, this looks a little different on the ultrasound than a simple cyst.
Absolutely.
What do you usually see what makes you think it may be an endometrioma rather than just a simple cyst?
The ultrasound findings of a cyst, and backing up just a little bit, the word cyst always conjures up all kinds of anxiety in my patients. So we always go through just a little a background and a little classification of cysts. A cyst typically means a collection of fluid. Simple cysts or cysts that belong at a certain time of the menstrual cycle generally show up as kind of a dark, very simple appearing collection of what looks probably like just fluid. And then an endometrioma, on the other hand, will be classified and would look completely different because it basically has kind of a ground glass appearance, or it looks like sometimes you'll actually see some of the characteristics that look like the endometrial lining as well. But you definitely see more of a distinct difference in the what's called an echotexture, or what it looks like visibly.
Yeah, I think that's important. And interestingly, too, when we see a cyst in women, which are very, very common, the majority of these will go away.
Exactly.
And when they go away, they're not anything to be concerned about. These endometriomas, are a collection of endometriosis in the ovary, tend not to go away. And a good cardinal rule about cysts on ovaries, almost like a lump in a breast, if it goes away, not a big deal. If it doesn't go away, then it's best to remove it.
Very true.
And we can also see that if you see this and you don't remove it, it tends to grow and can destroy the ovary. And then a woman is more at jeopardy to lose her ovary. A couple other little things I just wanted to mention. I did a little research on how extensive this is in terms of treatment, but also found an article that said that approximately $20 billion a year is spent on treatment of endometriosis. I know we we certainly see that it's prevalent and know that, but I was kind of blown away by that number. But that's pretty impressive. And we kind of feel, those of us that are doing infertility feel like it is more common because those are the kind of patients that come to us for treatment, because it also can make it harder for a patient to become pregnant. And one of the things that we, when we in a minute get to the treatment, we're going to want to kind of break it into two areas. One is just women with pelvic pain and women with fertility. And of course, those can overlap, but there will be women that have endometriosis, have the disease, have discomfort, that are not really ready to have a baby. They need to be treated as well as those that want to become pregnant and yet have this disease process that may be interfering with them becoming pregnant. Kind of like to go back just a little bit and talk about symptoms. Just in a woman who maybe is coming in for an annual exam, say she's not even really trying to get pregnant, what are the things in the history that would make you put up your antennas for maybe she's developing endometriosis?
Absolutely. And this goes back to when a woman sees her doctor, and one plea we always have is just to regularly see your doctor, especially in the field of gynecology. It's just so complicated. Symptoms to keep your ears open to: severe pain with menstrual cycles. That's just one of them. But people will come in, patients, their husbands, and they'll say, well, you know, my mom had bad pain with her cycles, and my sister has bad pain with her cycles. Everybody has bad pain with their cycles. That's true, but there is there comes a time where that painful cycle can be so incapacitating, literally renders someone unable to go to work or school or concentrate on studies or to do fun stuff. Another one that is very, very common and very, very highly, I would say that the majority of the time, high majority of the time, I find this particular symptom, and it is confirmed on an exam that there will be endometriosis present, is pain with intercourse deep in the very, very back part of what we call the cul-de-sac. On exam, that, of course, that can be confirmed almost pinpoint to find that. Those two things in combination are very, very common as far as having a very high likelihood of having endometriosis found at laparoscopy.
You know, and it kind of makes sense, because if any of our listeners have ever looked at a book of anatomy, at the back of the vagina is the cervix, and behind it is the lining on the inside of the pelvic cavity. And endometriosis tends to grow in that area. So it makes sense with penetration, with vaginal intercourse, that area could be bumped against, and that could cause pain.
Absolutely.
And therefore, if a gynecologist is doing a pelvic exam, he may actually feel some scarring or some lumpiness in that area when he's doing a pap smear or the typical annual exam. One of the other things I've noticed is that it seems that women who have really bad menstrual cramps, not all of them have been endometriosis. And in fact, maybe if they've been on an oral contraceptive agent, not necessarily for contraception, but just for the menstrual discomfort, if it goes away, they're probably less likely to have endometriosis. Where those where it didn't affect it at all, I think we would be more suspicious
right.
They'd have endometriosis. Don't you agree?
Absolutely. We always want to leave surgical evaluation as the last option, given certain conditions, of course, but that's always our first step, is to place patients on the oral contraceptive if they don't have any other contraindications, and it's a great way to find. And some patients who have endometriosis, their symptoms will be masked, and we'll probably talk about that later, but that's not such a bad thing.
That's not a bad thing at all, because if what we're really trying to do is to keep women comfortable during this period of time, and also to do the laparoscopies only when they're really indicated. Even though they're a minor procedure, they still have some risk involved. And so, we're coming up against a break. And so, what we'd like to do when we come back is maybe talk about the diagnosis a little bit more, the laparoscopy, describe it, and the treatments, medical and surgical, that are available. This is Beyond the Birds and the Bees. Please join us. Don't hesitate to call 390-1370. If you have any questions, we'll be back in a minute.
Satellite.
Welcome back to Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
Hi, I'm Dr. Thomas Fawn with the Texas Fertility Center, and our show is Beyond the Birds and the Bees, and we're coming back to our second segment. We've been talking about endometriosis, and I have a guest today, an obstetrician gynecologist, Dr. Devin Garza, who I think is real excited to be here because now he knows that he didn't have to work at the hospital today. And so we're glad that he's here, too, for different reasons. But welcome. And we were talking about endometriosis earlier. There's a couple other little things I wanted to kind of throw in before we get into treatment. And that is I had a couple of emails about questions, and I think they're kind of interesting. One is that does having intercourse during your menstrual period increase the chance or the risk of endometriosis? And this has never been proven, although I've heard that myth many times over the years. Another one, which is worth talking about shortly too, is does the use of tampons increase the risk of endometriosis? And this is very unlikely. The concept there, of course, we talked about that the endometrium, the lining of the uterus that comes out through the cervix every month as a menstrual period, can go backwards up through the fallopian tubes. And I guess the thought about that tampon was, or even intercourse was, in some way did that force the menstrual flow to go backwards or not allow it to escape through the vagina. I'm sure that's the basis for it, don't you think, Devin?
Exactly.
But I think that I don't think we have to worry about those things. But we talked a little bit about symptoms. It's kind of interesting. We have all seen this as gynecologists, that the quantity or the severity, I guess, of the disease doesn't always correlate with the severity of the symptoms. True. You've seen this.
Absolutely. You'll go in surgically, you evaluate, you find out what's going on regarding some of the symptoms that we talked about earlier, deep, very, very uncomfortable, painful sex. And, of course, that's the tip of an iceberg leading to very difficult relationship issues, as you could imagine. I'm sure there's some of you out there that know exactly what I'm talking about. Or just the kind of menstrual cycle pain that is incapacitating is really affecting your life in a negative way, even being on the birth control pill. And then you go in and you take a look. You don't see a whole lot. You may find a little bit, some lesions here and there. One of the other symptoms we didn't talk about is this chronic pelvic pain, or just a chronic, even intermittent pain that gets gradually worse over the last couple of weeks of the cycle and kind of culminates into this just really, really bad pain. But you'll go in, just like you said, and you'll be kind of surprised that you don't see much. Sometimes after treating that, and we'll talk a little bit about that, but after treating that, they get better, and sometimes the pain is still there.
Is it fair to speculate that maybe when it's really mild, when we're seeing it, and it's not associated with scarring, to maybe conclude that it's possible that it's there in addition to whatever's causing the pain?
Clearly.
Yeah, and I think the symptom that you brought up is very common, where women have this increasing discomfort premenstrual and almost with a little bit of relief after they get through the menstrual cramps. And so one of the other things that can do things like this or cause symptoms like this is irritable bowel syndrome. Mm-hmm. Because progesterone is released after ovulation, it tends to slow down the bowel motility. Women may say that they're a little bit constipated. Then they have a period and they have 2 or 3 bowel movements a day. And it may be that actually it's kind of put the rectal colon area into spasm, and that may be what is really the discomfort. So I think it's clear that it's not always as simple as it seems.
It really is. The body's an amazing, complex design that we find more and more about every day, but it just shows us how much we don't know. But in the area of pain, especially in the abdominal area, pelvic area, there's just so many different things it can be. We call that a differential diagnosis, or possibility of other causes other than the one that you think it is. And it's an amazing thing.
Well, since we had talked in the first segment about the gold standard for diagnosis is a laparoscopy, mm-hmm. let's talk about that a little bit. And sure. for the listeners that may not know what this is, in a nutshell, tell us what the procedure's like, how it's done, and how much time off work the patients have to take and everything.
Sure. Laparoscopy, the simplest way to put it, is The patient will go under anesthesia. General anesthesia is required. There will be varying degrees or numbers of very small incisions. Generally, we start with kind of hiding one in a little area of the belly button area, and we put a tiny scope in. Usually, it's 5 millimeters, and then we put another instrument in just to kind of help move the organs around to be able to see the areas that we've been talking about where endometriosis frequently is seen and sometimes hides. Most of the time, patients have about a 30-minute to an hour procedure, depending on how much we find. We may need to make additional incisions, which are, again, very tiny, a few millimeters. And then they'll go home the same day. They'll be out of commission. Everybody's different, of course. Everybody's got a different level of pain threshold. But in general, a few days to a week. Complete recovery or feeling no pain probably is at about the 2 to 3 week range.
Yeah, these incisions are very small, and of course we use stitches or sometimes a little like a glue to have the skin stick back together. The most important thing is women don't need to come back and have stitches removed, which is really, really more frightening than you appreciate until you've had that done.
Exactly. Yeah,
that's for sure. And also, a concept with this is really helpful. One is that incision at the umbilicus, the belly button, is where the camera goes most of the time to see the pelvis. The other small incision down around the pubic hair is to move the ovaries around so you can see on both sides. Think of this as you look up in the sky at the moon, and you really only see half of it if you see at least half of it when it's a full moon. So there could be things on the backside of the ovary. And in fact, wouldn't you say? Endometriosis is more commonly on the backside of the ovary, right?
Absolutely.
So if there's not that second incision, then you really might miss part of the disease. So that's real important. I know that stresses some patients to think, I'm going to have 2 or 3 incisions, but remember, they're really small and usually are not that uncomfortable after the procedure.
Exactly.
So this allows you to get a full view of the pelvis, front and back of the uterus, front and back of the ovary, around the fallopian tubes, and to feel really comfortable after you've had this view that you have found endometriosis that's there, or you can go out and say, you know what, you're normal.
Exactly.
And when we get to fertility a little bit with endometriosis, it's not so bad to be normal. I mean, it's actually really good, even though patients are sometimes hoping that you will find an answer, if you will. It turns out that endometriosis can cause infertility, but it could be there also in addition to whatever else the infertility problem is. But this is, I really do believe, well coined as the gold standard for diagnosis. And actually, now that we can use instruments through the laparoscope, like the laser and cautery, it's also the gold standard for treatment, don't you think?
That's the
How often do you think you really have to make a big incision at a later date to treat the disease?
Almost never. Very rarely. The key is exactly what you said. It's not just peeking in, saying, well, there it is, and closing shop. It's evaluating the extent and treating what you can visually see right in front of you with some great advances in technology and instrumentation.
And I think that that the concept in sort of general terms, if you see the disease, is either to destroy it or remove it. Those are the two general concepts. And it's interesting because endometriosis, it can kind of come in different forms, and patients don't really get to see it unless they can look at photographs after their procedure. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it looks black. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it looks bluish. Sometimes it looks red. And sometimes you will just see some white scarring. And so all of these can be disease lesions that need to be taken care of at that time. And
absolutely,
usually can be.
Yeah, definitely. Sometimes you'll see these areas are located over very vital structures. And so it sounds, on the one hand, not as scary maybe to some listeners, but on the other hand, for the surgeon, frequently you'll find these little areas that truly need to be treated or resected. The ovary can be overlying a very crucial structure that leads from the kidney to the bladder called the ureter, and some very, very large blood vessels. So being able to add those extra tiny incisions and instruments helps you to get that stuff taken care of.
Yeah, and I think it's important to know that there are different techniques to treat it, and in some places, different techniques work better. For instance, if it really is on the ureter, that tube from the kidney to the bladder, you really don't want to use a cautery because it spreads out and could injure the ureter. You'd much rather resect it with like a laser. The robot has been used in this. The pregnancy rates, the success rates are not any different. However, sometimes the robot may be a little bit beneficial when the disease is at a difficult area to resect. So for those patients out there that are seeing their gynecologist, they're probably the best thing for them to understand is that their surgeon, their physician, will know the best way to treat it. But how about if it's an endometrioma? I can't tell you how many times that we've seen patients that had a laparoscope before, they had an endometrioma, they drained the chocolate material, right? And it comes back.
Exactly.
So how do you approach that?
Those processes in the ovary are very caustic, and they are very, very important to manage. That cyst frequently doesn't have the type of easy access cyst lining that just peels off so easily as many as our other type of even tumors do. But that area of the endometrioma really must be resected. It has to be destroyed, that cyst lining, so that it doesn't recur.
Because the disease is really in the cyst lining. It's not the material that's inside.
Exactly.
And that's our experience as well. We open the ovary with a laser. We do find that wall, and we do try to strip or pull it out, and it's usually adherent. So we occasionally will then use the laser to kind of detach it from areas where it's very adherent. And then sometimes the ovary's closed and sometimes it's not afterwards, just what we feel will be the best healing process. But I think the important thing is if you have something like that, you need to get rid of the source, which is the cyst wall, not just the liquid that's
exactly
in between. Inside of the cyst. And I'm going to jump into fertility just for a minute. There's it appears that the more severe the disease, the more likely it is to cause problems with conceiving. So if you think of mild, moderate, and severe, severe disease is more likely to interfere with conceiving than mild disease. And there's even a classification called minimal, where you just see a few spots. And for a long time, we felt that this may or may not interfere with the ability to conceive. The Canadians did a study with 341 patients where they did a laparoscope, treated half the patients, didn't treat the other half, and get this, did not tell the patients. Can you believe that?
I can't believe
did not
it.
Tell the patients.
Is that
I mean, what a great
blind or something. I mean,
well, really? It was blinded. The patient was blinded in that she didn't know if she was treated or not. And it's a great study because then when they looked later and found out those that were treated had a higher pregnancy rate, thank you very much for the data. We could never do that in America, I don't
I
think.
Even believe.
But that endocan, we call it the endocan study, which was at the end of the 90s, did give us information to say that even when it's minimal, that it can interfere with fertility. And if you treat it, you can increase the chances of conceiving. So that was really important. And to be honest with you, we always treated it anyway. If we're there doing a laparoscope, who would just say, no, it's not important, leave it alone?
Right.
Wouldn't you
right.
treat it?
Of course.
Of course you would treat it. So I think that that's real important. Whenever you're taking care of a patient who has pain who doesn't want to be pregnant mm-hmm. at the time, maybe she's single, college or whatever, mm-hmm. but wants to preserve her fertility for the future, do you do anything in addition? If you're treating it laparoscopically, do you ever offer patient medication to follow up after
that?
Absolutely.
That's one of the best things you can do once you get to the diagnosis. Whether or not a patient wants to get pregnant or ever even wants to have kids but is experiencing these symptoms, the diagnosis of endometriosis allows you to then very confidently move forward with your therapies that are some of which very high-tech, very high-end, very costly. That cause some side effects that you probably wouldn't want to go through if you weren't certain you had endometriosis. Some of these gonadotropins and Lupron, and these are wonderful medications. It's kind of a 1-2 punch is what I explain to patients.
Yeah, I think that's very important. Well, we're coming up against another break that we need to take. And don't hesitate to give us a call at 390-1370. When we come back, we're going to talk more about the treatment of endometriosis. See you in a minute.
Talk Radio. Welcome back to Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
I'm Dr. Thomas Vaughn with the Texas Fertility Center, and as a guest, I have Dr. Devin Garza, who's an obstetrician gynecologist with the Renaissance Group out north near the Women's Hospital at North Austin Medical Center. This hour, we've been talking about endometriosis, not only symptoms, but also been talking a little bit about treatments, and we didn't finish up on treatments, so we want to pick up with that. And I had just talked about this Canadian study that had shown that patients that were treated with minimal disease actually could improve their fertility if they were treated, and therefore minimal disease could interfere with fertility. Although I think Dr. Garza and I both agree that it's uncommon for minimal disease to cause pelvic pain, particularly if there's no scarring in the pelvis, but just these little spots that look like maybe someone spilled a little pepper shaker in two or three spots of the pelvis. Mm-hmm. Don't you agree?
Mm-hmm, I do. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what we were talking about before we went to break is also this disease is sort of a chronic disease. It's a disease that doesn't necessarily go away until menopause. So if a gynecologist has a patient with endometriosis, it's something that they're going to deal with for a long time. And the gynecologist's role is to guide them through this by treating them to be sure that they keep it in check, if you will. And you talked a little bit about a drug called Lupron. And this Lupron medication is a medication that turns off the pituitary gland so the ovary can't be stimulated. And remember from the first segment, the ovary nourishes the endometriosis, so if you turn it off, then it kind of dries up a little bit. But you can't be on Lupron for too long of a time because a woman without estrogen for a long period of time can have problems.
Bone loss is certainly one of them.
And that's a major issue.
Huge.
You don't want to have brittle bones. You don't want to have osteoporosis when you're so young or even old.
I don't know anybody that could really withstand the symptoms of menopause when they're 32 or 33 or 34 years old. For 10 or 15 years either.
And that's a fair way of describing it as a medical menopause. Now, there is something called ADBAC, and that's where the woman's on the Lupron, and then she's given a medication called Agestin, which is actually a progesterone kind of compound that she can take and alleviate some of the symptoms of being on the Lupron and also help protect her bones. But it's important for women to know to not be on this medication, particularly for longer than 6 months. Having problems with the bones is just not a good thing. And we're not talking about cancer, right? We're just talking about structural strength of the bones.
Bone trabecular strength.
Yeah. And that actually is one of the best ways to treat it, but there are other ways. Have you ever used continuous birth control pills?
Of course. That's probably one of the most commonly chosen. If you offer treatment modalities after the diagnosis is made, after you've had your visit looking at your pictures, and you've shown before and after pictures, et cetera, and set up expectations, I'll have to tell you, most patients just don't choose Depo Lupron or long-acting Lupron because they're just a little afraid of it. So we tend to use a continuous birth control pill, and almost any pill will work. I'm sure the marketers of the pill industry don't want me to say that, but it's actually very true.
It's so true. It really needs to be a combination of estrogen and progesterone. And I personally think you get a little bit better benefit in monophasic. That means that both of the hormones are the same all the time, although the literature may not support that as well. But I know in these pills that are phasic or triphasic, where the doses change a lot, they're more likely to get cysts. Mm-hmm. They're just follicular cysts, not cancer, anything like that. Well, that suggests that there's still ovarian function going on. So my preference is actually to use a monophasic, same kind of pill, same dose, every day continuously.
Exactly.
And what do you think? I mean, even though it may not treat the disease itself, it probably inhibits continued growth. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to have menstrual discomfort if you don't have menses, right?
Exactly.
That's not a bad thing.
So if surgically you've managed, hopefully, whatever chronic pain was actually due to pelvic scarring, eliminated or really improved deep, painful intercourse pain, and you don't have a cycle, even if you can keep whatever, we kind of mentioned this residual or invisible endometriosis concept, if you can keep it in stasis and be symptom-free, I think that's winning the game of a chronic condition.
Yeah, I think so. And one of the things you said in the first segment, which I think is really very important, is you said, as long as a woman doesn't have a contraindication for the oral contraceptive agents or the birth control pills, and anyone who's listened to me knows that somehow I'm always going to get in to the subject, don't smoke. Oh, my God. It just kills eggs. It makes women more infertile. And also the combination that with a birth control pill increases the risk of a blood clot. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one of the things you're referring to. And some, what are the other contraindications of using a pill?
Anybody who's had a known prior reaction to anything, you generally will stay away from it. Anybody, specifically the pill, if you've had a blood clot at any point in your life or some kind of a stroke or an undiagnosed, what we call a thromboembolic event, would stay clear of the birth control pill. But clearly talk about this with your gynecologist and always give every bit of information history you can.
Now, and you know, there's something else I wanted to mention, and that is this continuous pill. This was actually developed in the late 70s and early 80s, and it was under the umbrella of something called pseudo-pregnancy. And it was developed to try to help people with their fertility. It didn't do very well with that. It does help with pain, but it didn't do as well with fertility. In other words, the observation was that if a woman had endometriosis and became pregnant, she was less likely to have it come back, or at least it took a longer period of time to come back, almost like pregnancy was mm-hmm. a treatment. Mm-hmm. And I've told patients pregnancy is probably the treatment of choice.
It is
the
treatment.
So the concept then in the 70s was, I know that's a long time ago, but the history helps. Jessica, you're laughing at me. I'm a little older than she. But anyway, it was that if you could create a false pregnancy, maybe you could treat it. After that came another drug that you may read about called danazole, and it's still out there. And it's actually it's still being used a little bit. It's a male hormone, and so therefore it has male hormone side effects. It's used a little bit more for fibrocystic breast disease. I don't know of anyone that's really using it much for endometriosis, but everyone searches the internet, so you may see these things. Now, the focus of our show is to try to preserve everything for reproduction. So we're always looking for a way to remove disease, save the ovaries, save the uterus, save the tubes, to have babies, even if you don't think you're going to. But what is the definitive treatment for endometriosis that the woman's through with childbearing?
The definitive endpoint for incapacitating symptoms and last choice after everything's been exhausted is what's called hysterectomy, which is removal of the uterus, cervix and uterus. We could always talk about those. But regarding ovaries, or what we call an oophorectomy, removing the ovaries along with the uterus is the final gold standard.
Yes, I don't think anybody would deny that, and certainly the good thing is can cure that disease. It's interesting. We've talked about this disease that is almost acts like a cancer sometimes. It's so aggressive in some people, but it is curable. Our goal is to try to keep it from getting to that point until the woman has completed her childbearing. And I think all the things that you've talked about with combination of surgery and hormonal therapy helps get us to that endpoint. I do think that we have to think of it again as a chronic disease. That means if you stop your treatment, then it's likely to come back. Mm-hmm. Just like if you have high blood pressure, you stop the blood pressure medicine, it tends to come back. Curable things, we would say, like strep throat, you take penicillin, strep is gone. But this is really a chronic problem, and women need to keep in contact with their gynecologist. women are pretty good about this. They do at least go for their annual exam and pap smear. Much better than men. What do you think?
What's an annual exam?
This is why we love being gynecologists, because women are so engaged in their health care.
They really and they're so
and they read about it, they're educated about it, and they want to do all the right things, and that's kind of what makes it fun. So I think it's fair to say that the key to treatment really aside from fertility is kind of relieving the symptoms so a woman can be functional. Don't you agree? Surgery probably is one of the things that should be considered if medical therapy has failed, but we tend to not want to do that unless we really need to.
Clearly.
And it is a very common disease. We've talked about that earlier in the program. It affects a significant number of women, and I'm sure we'll be talking about it for a long time. So if you have any questions about that, don't hesitate to email us here. And you know our phone number, 390-1370. You can also go on our website at www.texasfertility.com. What we're going to do next week is that Dr. Natalie Berger and Rinku Mehta at the Texas Fertility Center will have a guest, Chris Hart, who's a gynecologist with the Hill Country OB-GYN group that practices primarily South Austin and Seton Southwest. And they will be discussing several topics, one of which is minimally invasive gynecological surgery. So thank you for joining us today. We hope you have a good Saturday, and we'll see you next week on the radio.
Let me tell you about the birds and the bees and the flowers and the trees, the moon up above, and a thing called...